Okay, so Rick is here, right? Good. Rick is right here.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rick.
As before, you know, I'm going to let Rick really provide the content, but I'd like to give you his background, his bio. Rick Doblin, PhD. Rick Doblin, PhD, is the founder in 1986 and president of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. His dissertation at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government was on the regulation of the medical use of psychedelics and marijuana. And his master's thesis, also at Harvard, focused on the attitudes and experiences of oncologists concerning the medical use of marijuana. His undergraduate thesis at the New College of Florida was a 25-year follow-up to the classic Good Friday experiment, the miracle at Marsh Chapel, which evaluated the potential of psychedelic drugs to catalyze religious experience. He also conducted a 34-year follow-up study of Tim Leary's Concord Prison Recidivism Experiment. Doblin's also studied with Stan Groff, MD, and was in the first group to become certified as a holotropic breathwork practitioner. You know, we all know Rick and another gentleman today who needs no introduction, although I've just given you one. And I just want to add what I know we all really share is our gratitude for all the works Rick has done. Really, if you look at the panel, at the speakers over the last 2 days, much of it would not have been possible. Much of it just wouldn't even be here if Rick was not here. So I just want to take the opportunity to give him, for all of us, incredible gratitude and thanks. So I'll turn you over to Rick.
To be here. I'd like to thank Neil and Kevin for organizing this conference and bringing us together. And Kevin and Hillary and Martha, who are at the MAPS table in the back, if you have any questions, and all of you are here. My talk today is about mainstreaming psychedelic medicine. Patience is the fastest way. And the fact that I could even talk about mainstreaming psychedelic medicine is due in large part to the strength of our community. Okay, so that if you were to just look around and think of the people that are here, there's not a lot of black people here, but we are fairly diverse in terms of the mainstream culture, and we have links into pretty much everywhere. And this was really highlighted to me a couple years ago when I was in Israel and I was climbing Masada, and I was climbing it in the sun, before the sunrise, with a German psychiatrist whose father had been a Nazi. And so one generation down, we were taking MDMA together and climbing up this beautiful hill up to this fort where there had been a major battle thousands of years ago, several thousand years ago. And when I got up to the top, and I'm not sure how many, the story of Masada is basically rebels from the Roman Empire, Jewish rebels who were captured Herod's castle and hid out there for a couple years and then were just overwhelmed and committed suicide right before they were about to be captured. And so when I got up to the top of Masada, I realized that I'm also a zealot in a different way than these zealots were. And that our community of psychedelic researchers, the psychedelic underground, the psychedelic artists, that we all do have a certain kind of zeal and a passion for what we do, but that there is a fundamental difference between where we're at and where the zealots were at the top of Masada. And we have incredible mobility, we have access to the internet, we have access to resources, we blend with the main culture, we're not able to be really identified that easily and isolated. And at the same time, we have something that the mainstream culture desperately needs, these tools for healing. We're in a time of crisis, environmental, social, economic, all different ways. And so I think that I drew a heart from this one generation down, being with a man who grew up under Nazism, and a sense that we have a chance. We really do, to bring the psychedelic consciousness into our society for all the benefits that we've heard about these last couple of years, the last couple of days, and actually the last 40 years or so since the 60s. So that makes me really then say, we have a precious opportunity. How is it that we're going to manage it so that we don't see the kind of backlash that happened in the 60s and wiped out the research pretty much all over the world for a very long time? And I think that there are some lessons from the past that we can learn and study. I was not here yesterday. I really wanted to be here yesterday, but a close family friend was having his daughter bat mitzvah. So I was in Temple, and I just thank God I'm a Reformed Jew. There's a lot of things that are difficult about the tradition, but at the same time, I think it's really important to sort of honor where we came from and come back to it in our own ways and bring things to it and enrich it. So I felt like this balance between work and family, that it was really important for me to stay home and to go. This fellow who was, his daughter was getting bat mitzvah, is the oncologist on our MDMA cancer anxiety study at Harvard. But while I was there, I heard this horrible story about another member of the congregation who had died on Friday morning. And he was a 47-year-old man who had a wife and three children. I knew him. His wife had been my girlfriend a long time ago, before I met my wife. And he had gone with a bunch of his friends to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And this was a trip of a lifetime, but he didn't feel like he was quite ready. He wasn't sure he was in good enough shape. A friend of his said beforehand, just don't kill yourself. And he ended up a short distance from the top, just dying. And this is something that shocked everybody. And we really were trying to come to grips with it. And it brought me in mind of this topic, patience is the fastest way. That there is a way where you push yourself too fast and you end up with fatal consequences. Now, there's sort of sins of omission and sins of commission. And by that I mean that there are things that you do, sins of commission, that turn out to be mistakes, and then there's sins of omission, which is things that you should have done that didn't, but you didn't do. And so it's easier to see the sins of commission when you do something that you shouldn't do, and then there's consequences. So those are identifiable. And the sins of omission, the things that you should have done but didn't, are awful hard to see. And I think that because they're hard to see, we tend to commit those sins more often. And so I would put on that side, going too slow. There's a lot of opportunities, there's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of dire need, and so we can go too slow. Patience is not complacency. But at the same time, we can go too fast. And I think that in my personal life and in the balance that I'm trying to strike, that I really am very aware of the sins of omission, of the lost opportunities, and of the dire nature of our global situation. So I often, I'm more willing to sort of go too fast and suffer those consequences than I am to go too slow. So my mistakes will be more visible, I think. And yet, at the same time, you know, you don't know where the edge is until you're over it. But you don't want to do it in a way that's really too endangering yourself. So this idea of this pace of change, we're in a time where it's an extremely precious opportunity right now. And to give you an example of that, on Friday, we finished, the last final data was gathered in our U.S. MDMA post-traumatic stress disorder study. It was a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment. It took us, since 1984, is when I started trying to work on MDMA psychotherapy research. It took till 2004 to get the study started, so it was 20 years to get it started. It took a while after that to, you know, get all the money, get it together. So it was $1 million, 4.5 years, and now we have incredible data. We haven't hurt anybody in the study, no serious adverse events, and we have results that are better than anything the pharmaceutical company can do by 300%, and we have data that's in some people better than what psychotherapy can do as well, because we're only working with treatment failures. People have had to fail on psychotherapy and also pharmacotherapy. So we have now basically set the stage for the next 10 years. I used to talk about a $5 million five-year plan. And I talked about that for probably 10 years. And I'm now speaking about a $10 million 10-year plan. But that's based on a more realistic assessment of what our challenges are ahead. We're much farther along, we have a lot of data. So I think realistically, if someone were to write me a check for $10 million right now, in 10 years I could give them back approval for MDMA as a prescription medicine. Not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. I do think that that's realistic. Now, Monday of last week, we also got word from the FDA that they had accepted completely our Swiss LSD end-of-life anxiety study protocol. So all of our foreign studies we submit to the FDA. And the basic idea here is that we're going to do a series of studies in the United States and a series in Europe, Israel, and the Middle East. And then we cross-submit to the European Medicines Agency and the FDA. So we will hopefully simultaneously get approved in the United States and Europe. So the fact that the FDA has now accepted LSD-assisted psychotherapy is a major, major milestone. That is the culmination of this first phase of the psychedelic renaissance. LSD as the most controversial drug and LSD as a tool for psychotherapy. The FDA has also accepted a study which is now started in the United States using LSD for understanding creativity and brain function. So LSD is in the scientific hands again. And as Winston Churchill said about one phase of World War II, he said, after a particular victory, he said, this is not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning. And I think that's where we are with psychedelic research. We are at the end of the beginning, we have this chance, and we have to look carefully, how do we avoid the backlash, and how do we offer hope to the society so that they're letting us to go forward. And there's a publisher, Jeremy Tarcher, who sent me, also on Monday, the same day I heard from the FDA about the LSD study, he sent me in the mail, it was a document, he'd been going through his files, and it was a signed copy by Timothy Leary of a letter that he wrote in 1960 to Aldous Huxley. And it was the attempt, Aldous was over at MIT, he was at Harvard, it was an attempt to bring these two groups together. Aldous, who studied, who'd written about psychedelics in the 50s, who was very interested. So it brought me in mind of this particular letter. I've done a lot of research into Timothy Leary and Harvard and what happened and what went right, what went wrong. And there's a document that I'm going to read you some from that was written in October 1961. And it was by David McClelland, who was a professor at Harvard in the School of Social Psychology. And he was starting to get nervous about what Tim Leary was doing and what this psilocybin project was up to. And there was a big faculty meeting that was going to gather to talk about what was going on. And these are his notes. And as I read them today, there's things that I think we really need to be paying attention to in our efforts over the next decade or two decades to really further do this mainstreaming of psychedelics into our culture. So what he's describing is what he thinks are the sort of flaws in thinking of this psilocybin project. And the first one, he says, is he thinks about psychedelics in terms of sort of mystics who go meditate on mountains and withdraw from society. And so he trashes the whole Indian society as poverty, squalor, and meanwhile you got these people who are just going off on their own selfish pursuits up into the mountaintops and meditating. And so he says that he's really concerned that psychedelics produce or have a tendency to produce disassociation and detachment. The way he describes this is, quote, from the subjective point of view, this appears apparently largely as a gain. From the social point of view, it has many negative features. Initiates begin to show a certain blandness or superiority or feeling of being above and beyond the normal world of social reality. They feel sorry for those who have not had the experience. Social rules, roles, and regulations seem remote and slightly ridiculous. Everything is a game. All is illusion, even self. In other words, the inner world of fantasy, so he's not really giving it much credibility, but the inner world of fantasy is valued more than the outer world of social reality. So we know that around this time, too, Tim was starting to talk about everything as a game and how he was starting to feel that this scientific process that he was involved in was too constricting. And I think that things would have been a whole lot different if he would have found a way to stay within this scientific context. But we know how history turned out. Now, the second part he talks about is what he calls interpersonal insensitivity. And so we've heard about the mystical experience, the sense of connection. And so what David McClellan is saying is, as a hypothesis, I would suggest that the feeling of sensitivity is in fact an undifferentiated sensitivity in which one feels a kinship to all human beings, not the unique personality showing marked individual differences. In other words, differential sensitivity is decreased by psilocybin, while a feeling of cosmic oneness is increased. So he's saying that people are really starting to get alienated from this psilocybin project, and he's saying that Leary's talking all about this cosmic togetherness, but he's not paying attention to the community in which he's existing right at the time. Then he says there's an omniscience, religious, and philosophical naivete. What appears to be going on here is a recreation of the childhood faith and the omnipotence of thought without the discipline, again, of testing these thoughts against the reality of religious, philosophical, and social traditions. So I think that what really he's pointing to here is the need to bring science and religion together and to really subject what we experience in psychedelic states to logic and to rational thought, and that they're not inherently opposed to each other, but that if you get sort of what's been ridiculed in a way as New Age thinking, New Age, you know, without any kind of reality checking, that's what he saw starting to be happening here. Then he talks about impulsivity. And he says, the history of, now, impulsivity is also like focusing on the moment. So we talk a lot about how psychedelics bring us into the moment. But what David says is, the history of the project has been marred by repeated ingestions of the drug, group decisions made which are not carried out. One can hardly fail to infer that one effect of the drug is to decrease responsibility or increase impulsivity or acting on the spur of the moment in terms of one's subjective field at the time. Again, note the increased valuation put on immediate subjective experience. It is in these terms that the failure to foresee negative consequences mentioned above can perhaps be understood. One becomes present, not future-oriented. So I think this is a really, really important point. It's not just like this Dionysian license to do whatever you want to do, that there does need to be a focus and a spontaneity, but you also still have to recognize how you're acting within a cultural context. And if we avoid these different mistakes, we have a chance of integrating. But if we really don't pay attention to the lessons of the past, and to summarize, how to prevent disruptive modes of thought, perhaps especially among those who administer it, since they take it too, and, quote, how to prevent the absorption in one's own thought processes from creating social withdrawal, insensitivity, impulsivity, and an unrealistic sense of omniscience. So it's important to learn from our critics. And I think that there's a lot to be said here for how we can make it in a successful way to take advantage of the fact that we are now showing that psilocybin can produce mystical experiences that people say is one of the most important experiences of their lives, that we can help with post-traumatic stress disorder, and that we can help people face death with a little bit more peace to it, so that we have incredible things to offer to this society. To give you an example, in a way, of the MDMA post-traumatic stress disorder study, we had two veterans from Iraq who were in the study who had post-traumatic stress disorder from the war. The VA was not able to help them. the VA didn't even want them to be in the study. We had to do a lot of struggle to find vets and go around the VA. But we were finally able to do that, and these guys are now doing much, much better. We had a woman who was on disability for 20 years after her husband went berserk and tried to kill the kids, tried to kill her, and committed suicide in front of them. She hasn't been able to work for 20 years. After three sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, she has now gone back to work. Now, I'm not saying it works like this with everybody, but I'm saying that we have some really remarkable stories of healing that are compelling, and that I think that we can use them both to attract the permissions that we need all over the world, and also the resources that we need to do these studies. We're in a cap to provide psychedelic emergency services. So we're trying to show that people that end up with difficult experiences, if you work with them in a sensitive way, and you give of yourself an enormous amount of time, sometimes a whole day, sometimes 12 hours, that you can actually help people move through these difficult states and end up learning something from it, often going back to the party, you know, wiser and sobered up a bit, but that we can take these casualties and really minimize them and really help people to grow from these difficult experiences. So two people came to us who'd heard about the work we were doing, and they were both interested in doing MDMA, but they wanted people to sit with them. One person had been raped at Burning Man 4 years ago, and another person had post-traumatic stress disorder from 9/11. The last 5 years, we have been looking for somebody that had post-traumatic stress disorder from 9/11. Again, I mean, as Neil told you, my degree is in public policy. So this is, my work is this combination of politics and science, and also art, the art of therapy, which is as much an art as the art that we've been fortunate enough to watch and observe earlier today. So that there is this ability to communicate to larger groups by picking sort of diseases that people are compassionate about, post-traumatic stress disorder, diseases that everybody will have, anxiety about dying, and so also trying to find somebody from 9/11. So at Burning Man, there they were. And these people were able to make incredible progress. And to be able to see that firsthand, it's been very inspiring to me to, it's not just a theory, it's not just data, it's not just numbers, it's not just a study, it's like real human lives, and real richness is coming out through this engagement with their problems. So that we have, I've been inspired, and that's helped me to say, okay, I'll give up with the $5 million plan, and I'll acknowledge that it's going to take a little bit longer. But I think that's really a healthy process to really acknowledge that. And I think for those of us who are parents, you know, you think about your children and they're little kids, and before you know it, they're off to college. So a 10-year plan, a 20-year plan is really not that much. That's one of the benefits of aging, is your sense of time changes. And while time gets more and more precious, it also gets easier and easier to think in longer periods of time. So what is it that we have to do to make MDMA into a prescription medicine? Where we're at now is what's called the phase two process. And this is where you develop your method, you see how strong your effect is. You're basically planning for what's called the phase three studies. So at the phase three level, we're gonna probably need about two studies, about 300 people in each one. And we're gonna need about 15 or so therapy teams. Our model is male-female co-therapist teams. Came from Stan Grof, and it just has worked out really, really well. So I think this balance of masculine-feminine works as a co-therapist team. It's tremendous. And it's expensive, though, too, because you got two therapists, not just one. And it's roughly 40 hours of therapy in a four-month process for two different therapists. So it's 80 hours of therapy. So if it's even $100 an hour, it's $8,000 just for the therapy. So this is not as cheap as giving somebody a prescription for Zoloft or Paxil, but it's attempting to reach down to a cure rather than to just work on symptom relief. So that what we have to do is refine our method, and we're now having teams, we're spending about $25,000 just for several teams to watch the videotapes of the therapy sessions and try to develop a training program that doesn't involve drugs, where we would offer this to these male-female co-therapist teams. We also have to have operationalized this treatment manual so that blinded independent raters can observe videotapes of therapy sessions. They won't know whether they're MDMA or placebo sessions, but they have to score the therapist on how well do they comply to the method. So, you know, we are talking about the art of therapy, but now we're talking about the science of it and getting it extremely rigid and very controlled. So we have to make sure that there's the same kind of therapeutic method that's being used in 20 or 30 different locations. So now we're working on that. And we also believe, now, a lot of this was about the concerns at Harvard that Leary and the bunch were taking the drugs themselves. And it's possible to take the drugs too often, but it's also possible to take them not often enough. So it's our view that a therapist would be better if they have tried MDMA themselves. Not that everybody who takes MDMA as a therapist would be better than every other therapist. There's all this individual variability in therapeutic skill. But it's our view that just the same way that a meditation teacher wouldn't teach meditation without having learned how to meditate, that psychoanalysis, if you want to practice it, you have to have your own psychoanalysis. There's loads of examples of like this. But our challenge is going to be to get permission from the FDA to give MDMA to therapists as part of their training. And we're not going to require it. We have to watch out about this accusation that we're sort of building a cult, that everybody who does this therapy must do these drugs. So the MDMA portion of it, if we get permission for it, is going to be optional. The non-drug portion is the main thing. And we still, though, the best way to think about MAPS is as a nonprofit psychedelic and medical marijuana pharmaceutical company. And our role model is actually women's reproductive health, is the development of the abortion pill RU-486. That was so controversial that no pharmaceutical company would take it on. And so Planned Parenthood worked with the Population Council, and they developed a nonprofit that got multi-millions donated from Warren Buffett. And they did this development, and they made RU-486 into a prescription medicine. So that it's not a unique model that we're trying to advocate here. And in fact, the Bill Gates Foundation is now supporting a lot of nonprofit drug development, but those are usually drugs for diseases for poor people in Africa. They've put in over $100 million into nonprofit drug development. The psychedelics are not patentable. They're in the public domain. Their use is not patentable because we've talked about all the different uses, so you can't get a use patent. And these drugs, when they're used in our method, they're only used a few times. They're not used every day. So that it's not a profitable model from the pharmaceutical industry. And the governments aren't going to give money now, and the big foundations aren't either because it's too controversial. So it's falling to our community to produce all of this data and act like we're a pharmaceutical company. And so we're having more and more people from the mainstream pharmaceutical companies. In fact, the irony for me is that a woman from Novartis, now Novartis is the company that bought up Sandoz, which is where Albert Hoffman worked. So now we have somebody from Novartis who monitors clinical trials, has trained our staff on how to do clinical research monitoring, which is extremely expensive. And we have other sort of defectors from the pharmaceutical industry who are coming to help us in our drug development. Some anonymously, there's a woman who wrote an article about data management in this issue of the MAPS Bulletin that's up on the website, and she wasn't comfortable putting her name or her pharmaceutical company affiliation down, but we're getting more professionalized. And basically for the next 2 years, we're going to be doing a series of what's called phase two pilot studies. And we have ones going on right now in Switzerland and Israel. The Swiss study is about half done. The Israel study is just beginning. We're starting a study. It's before an institutional review board in Canada. And the big dream there is that there's a possibility that we might be able to get some police officers from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police who were traumatized as in their jobs working as police officers into the study. So again, we're trying to break down these stereotypes of who does these drugs. And it's for everybody. It's for the mainstream. It's not for this counterculture. We are not a counterculture. We are trying to be integrated. We're like the scouts who were sent out to check something out. We've come back, we've got some really good information, and now we want to have the whole tribe sort of go in this direction. And we can do it. So in addition to trying to develop our treatment manual, develop our training program, and replicate our results, we're also sort of living out the big dream. So we're trying to, I call it psychedelic diplomacy. So I've just been in Amman, Jordan, and I've met with various political officials there. We're working with a Jordanian military psychiatrist, and so we're hoping to start a PTSD study in Jordan. We have other projects in Spain and France and possibly in Portugal. So that we're internationalizing it, so that if there is a backlash in any one of these countries, we'll be able to continue in other countries. It's hard to say what will happen in November here in the United States, so we really have to have this international strategy. And then once we've got this data, then we go to the FDA and we say, how do we design these phase 3 studies? What kind of studies will you accept as convincing proof of safety and efficacy? And so I think that that'll probably take place around 2 years from now. Now, the whole other line that we're trying to do, and Roland talked about it, is working with people that are dying. And that's very, very important, but I think that it's not likely to be the high priority, the top priority that makes it through the FDA first. First off, I think most psychiatrists, or a lot of them, are scared of LSD, scared of psilocybin, scared of taking those drugs themselves, and they're willing to try MDMA in order to be more effective therapists. But the other problem is that we have to treat disease. I mean, there is a whole parallel track, which is trying to legitimize the religious use of these drugs, which is very, very important. But religious use is very close to drug legalization. What the government has tried to do is say, if you're a member of the Native American Church and you have permission to use peyote, you have to be a Native American. So we have a situation where we have, from the federal government's perspective, they've limited a religion to people from a certain race. Never happened before. It's outrageous. But that's how they're trying to pocket, to keep it in this isolated pocket. Similarly with the Unidad Vegetal, which is approved by the Ayahuasca Church. It's a very small group. The Santo Daime has just sued the DEA. They want to get authorized as well. But what about those of us who are allergic to religion and allergic to sort of orthodoxies? Why can't we have our own spiritual experiences just, you know, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, on mushrooms, or wherever? We should. So I think that the religious use and the research into the religious use is very important, but it is so threatening because it is so next to this idea of legalization and personal human rights for everybody to have this direct access to spirituality, that I don't see that as also being the one that breaks the barrier. And then there are efforts to work on drug decriminalization, drug legalization. And I think that that will move in parallel also. But I think that the talk that Alex and Allison gave this morning about what do you tell the kids, it's really instructive. And that's where really this whole war is being waged. If you look at how prohibition ended by women, by mothers, getting together and saying that prohibition was more dangerous to their kids than alcohol. So it was the Women's Christian Temperance Union that helped bring about prohibition in the first place. And then it was the largest group of people that ended up stopping prohibition was this group of women. And we don't see that right now. So when you think about parents' groups in who have something to do with drugs, they're almost always parents' groups who are pro-drug war. So that our movement is not mature yet, or the legalization movement, is not mature yet because there really is not this organized group of parents, vocal, strong, saying the drug war is more dangerous than our kids. So I think that there's a good chance that the medical use will be the one that both gives us the opportunity to counteract the incredible propaganda that has demonized these drugs and will appeal to people on the basis of their need, on the basis of their need for healing. And so I'm not clear that that's right. So I'm very supportive of working people that are working on legalization, people that are working on religious use. I just felt that my particular point of leverage was most focused by working on the medical use. And I think that when we talk about people that are dying, trying to make it into a disease, trying to show that the existential healing that people can go through with psychedelics and get more peaceful about their death, whether that maps onto the traditional measures of anxiety is not clear yet. That's what these studies, pilot studies in that area, are trying to do. So we're probably a year or so behind the MDMA PTSD research with the work with the people that are dying. And it's not clear to me that that's going to work out at all. It may. It's really important to show that we can have this helpful effect. But I think that right now, MDMA PTSD is the one. Now, I had initially thought that I want to have the MDMA studies done, at the phase two studies done for MDMA, for PTSD, and the phase two studies done for psychedelics, for end-of-life anxiety, and then we go to the funders and say, now look at the data, now let's figure out which is best. And we had our recent MAPS board meeting, and we decided that that's not necessary anymore, that the MDMA PTSD stuff is so good and so strong that it justifies going forward full steam ahead. So that's where we're at. We're proliferating all these pilot studies, and we'd like to encourage, it can only be done with all of us working together, so I do encourage you to consider becoming a MAPS member. There was one week a couple years ago where we got a $250,000 check in the mail, and a drug war prisoner sent us 8 stamps. And I felt that each of those donations was equally important, that somebody who was in jail for selling LSD would send us 8 stamps in hopes that somehow or other he would be able to help out. Meant as much to me as a billionaire sending us $250,000. So I think everybody can do their part. It doesn't matter how big, how small. But I think working together, we're a very strong community. We're not like the zealots up on top of Masada. And society needs what we have to offer. And it's incredibly exciting to be able to work on this. This work is its own reward. It's so beautiful to work with people as they open up. So with that, I'd just like to say thank you all for attending and being here and joining together and making us feel strong as a community. And now we'll open it up to questions. Okay, the question is, as we try to make MDMA into a medicine, will it require congressional action to reschedule MDMA, or can it be done just through the FDA? The answer is that it can be done just through the FDA, and that's why it makes sense to try this strategy. The FDA can say, this drug has been proven to be safe and efficacious for this particular indication. So it must go from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. Schedule 2 is still drugs that have a high potential for abuse. The penalties are still the same for non-medical use. The DEA comes in, and the FDA Office of Controlled Substances, where they try to decide, should it be Schedule 3, should it be Schedule 4, what kind of regulation should control it. We have only one example of where Congress acted, and that's with the drug GHB. Ironically, it's with a psychedelic drug. That GHB has been made into a medicine for narcolepsy, for people who fall asleep during the day, and they don't get good enough sleep at night, so they get prescribed GHB to help them sleep at night. And what the company that did this research is, they made this kind of Faustian bargain with the government, and they basically said, if we will help you crack down on the non-medical use of GHB, but we'll tell you all the different ways of synthesizing it, we'll tell you where all the precursors are, and if we do that to help you, will you help us by making a special law? And what they passed was, GHB is in Schedule 1 if it's used non-medically, but it's in Schedule 3 if it's used for medicine. Schedule 3, you don't have to have triplicate prescriptions, the DEA doesn't keep as close of a watch on it, it makes a whole lot of a financial difference to a pharmaceutical company if their drug is Schedule 3. So we don't need DEA to agree. They must make it into a Schedule II medicine if the FDA says yes. So that's where our strength is. And right now, it's really important to think about the government as, I mean, if you think about how many fights we have between those of us who are in this community, which is a lot, think about the government as that way too. So there's no the government. The government is all these different groups fighting against each other all the time. And so what we have to do is find what the institutional missions are of the different agencies. So the DEA is just sustain the drug war, promote the drug war, scare people about the drugs. NIDA used to be the National Institute on Drug Abuse, helping people deal with addiction. It was sort of captured by Alan Leshner and others who decided that the best way to build up the budget of NIDA was to put science in the service of the drug war. The Drug Czar's office is obviously sort of focused on it. But the FDA's mission is to develop medicines to help people. And they're used to narcotics for pain. They're used to all sorts of stuff. So the FDA is not on our side, but they are on the side of science over politics. And that's all the opening that we need. Yes?
Salvia divinorum presents us with an unusual situation where we have a major psychedelic that is still remaining legal in 2008. What do you think is the best way of assuring that it remains legal?
The question is about salvia divinorum. It's a major psychedelic. It's still legal right now federally. It's already illegal by a bunch of states. And the question is, what can we do about it? And basically nothing. I mean, I think that this idea of patience being the fastest way is you have to realize when you're outgunned, when you are not very powerful. And so this like prohibition machine has grabbed hold of salvia, and it's just gonna roll right over everybody that does it. So the other thing I would say though is that it's not that much of a problem from our point of view. Because trying to develop psychedelics into medicine, salvia I don't think has much in the way of therapeutic potential. And even if it did, we couldn't afford to develop it into a medicine. What we need is drugs that have been demonized for decades. And governments all over the world have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on what's wrong with these drugs. So that is the situation with marijuana, with LSD, with psilocybin, particularly with MDMA. There's hundreds of millions of dollars on the risks that we can capture. We have spent about $150,000 on having a woman, Ilse Jerome, read every single paper ever published in the scientific literature on MDMA, summarize them, and keep up to date with it. So we have been able to capture several hundred millions of dollars worth of research for $150,000. And so that's why I think it's reasonable to say this $10 million 10-year plan, because pharmaceutical companies will tell you that it takes $1 billion, it can't be done the way we're doing it, but they're starting out with a new drug. We're starting out with a drug that was invented, MDMA, invented in 1912, synthesized 12, patented 1914. Tens of millions of people have taken it, hundreds of millions have been spent on it, but all on the risks. So now we have a terrific opportunity to just focus on the benefits. So it really is both practical, it's the Aikido strategy, is we take the energy of the demonization and use it to our benefit. Yes. Yeah. So I'll say this, that I took one of my MDMA trips that I took by myself was I camped out all night near Big Sur, and I was doing all this projecting on a tree, and I was imagining that the tree was the DEA looking at me. And I was trying to figure out how do I stay safe from this kind of DEA perspective. And so my training also has been more and more to understand what the DEA's concerns are and what our society's concerns are, and to some extent sympathize with them. So my approach to MDMA is that I think that it should be regulated in a highly controlled manner. I think that the medical use is not the same as the debate over legalization. We're talking about medical use. So that psychedelics, and this is, I guess I'll leave you with this, is that the reason we're going nowhere with marijuana, making it into a medicine, we've been trying since 2001 to get a license to break the federal monopoly on marijuana. We won a DEA lawsuit, we have 45 members of Congress, 2 senators in our favor, but we're still going nowhere. So that marijuana is not happening yet on a federal level, but psychedelics were making a lot of progress. And the reason is that marijuana, from a police point of view, is a total nightmare as a medicine. Because if you use marijuana, chances are you've got some chronic condition. Pain, MS, nausea for chemotherapy, at least while you're undergoing chemotherapy, AIDS, HIV, all sorts of stuff. And so you take the drug at home, and you administer it to yourself multiple times a day, and you get a month's supply or so, and who knows who you give it to, what happens. So controlling diversion from the police perspective on medical marijuana is a total nightmare. And actually, if you go to California, you see it is a nightmare for them from a diversion point of view. Psychedelics offer us this incredible opposite situation, where if we say, you never get psychedelics as a prescription to take home and do on your own. It's psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. So you only get the drug under supervision of therapists. And I do believe that we constantly have to be aware of this backlash potential. And so we have to grow in a slow, careful way. And I think that people will need special training. Actually, we will be the ones to provide it, so that the people that do the studies that are used as evidence to make it into a medicine have developed the method. And then I think we will train, I think the FDA will require us to train psychiatrists and therapists in our method. However, we're not like trying to dictate how everybody should use it. So that once somebody has been through the training in our method and they can use it in therapy, they can use their own method. Physicians can prescribe off-label, so that there are, we think we have a method. This woman, there are other people with different methods who have been able to achieve great success. So I think that we should also limit it to special clinics as a further safety. And I'll say that in 1974 was the first hospice center in the United States. And in 2004, there was over 3,000 hospice centers over a 30-year period. So I think that we'll eventually have psychedelic clinics in every town in America, probably, big enough to have, Starbucks or something. So I think that I am, and the board members of MAPS, one of them is a major libertarian. So there's constant pressure to sort of open it up to everybody, and is resisting a lot of these ideas. But personally, I feel it should be highly controlled at the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Just beautiful. Yes.